The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora everybody, and thanks very much for joining me for today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood from climate strategy company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Well, today we're going into Climate Matters number 138. Now, it was brought out about a month ago. We've had so many interviews plus the local government candidate special that we're running a bit behind on this, but here's what we're going to cover. A rather belated report on the bottom trawling protest at Nelson, Port Nelson, but also some important other information related to the cost of bottom trawling. Then another item, are we on a fool's errand with our energy for data centres? Some pretty striking information there. Another encouragement for you to vote, including going to the, if you want, to the Resilience web page for a whole lot of interviews with climate specialists on local government. Or you could go to the Climate Matters a couple of weeks ago where we went through all the local Nelson. In terms of those interviews, we also have a clip from Susan Crumdyke, Professor Susan Crumdyke, who's the lead at Heriot Watt University in Scotland of energy transition. Then a piece on Shane Jones singing from the same energy song sheet as Donald Trump. Interesting to put that against Susan Crumdyke. And for good value, we're also putting a short Susan Crumdyke clip at the end of that. Then we're going to give an answer that we failed to give in Climate Matters number 137. What was the answer to what is Hydrogel Bioink? Then if we have time, and we may not, there'll be a longer read on ruminants and agriculture. Oh, well, that seemed a long introduction. Anyway, on to the protest at Port Nelson, where some local members of Greenpeace activists boarded a Talley's deep bottom trawling ship with a big protest describing it as an ocean killer. Okay, that's old news from a local topicality point of view, not from a climate point of view. But also, it's worth noting a very recent article in the Lancet Planetary Health. Lancet, of course, is a well-known journal on the huge carbon emissions that result from the disturbance of carbon-rich sediments on the sea floor. That wasn't mentioned by David Attenborough in the Oceans film. There was enough bad news in that as it was. But here's a little bit of an extract from that Lancet Planetary Health article. Globally, the report found, bottom trawling emits about 1 gigaton of CO2 annually, matching aviation's footprint. In other words, bottom trawling around the world is causing as much emissions as aviation is. That's a staggering comparison. And when they were analyzing the EU bottom trawling fishery, they found the cost of the carbon, that is the carbon released through disturbing the sediments, outweighed the value of the fish caught. How crazy is that? And we also give a link to a Radio New Zealand report in which the boss of Talley's accuses the protesters of having, quotes, no regard to health and safety, close quotes. If only Talley's had better regard for the health and safety of the oceans and of our future. So not so good on that. Now, I mentioned that I'd talk a little bit about the clips. These are from, if you remember, at the last local government election, I interviewed 16 remarkable specialists. And here's one of them. This is Susan Crumdyke. She had been on the staff at Canterbury University School of Engineering. She is now the Professor of Energy Transition at Heriot Watt University in Scotland. And she was in that position when I talked to her 3 years ago. Here's what she had to say.
It feels good to feel like you have a solution. And so we have to understand that we want solutions. And when you say, okay, I understand climate change. So our our politicians. We've got very few who are holding out that climate change isn't a problem, right? Mm. So we all agree climate change is a problem. Well, now I want to grasp a solution. And so those sort of shiny objects seem like great solutions.
Yeah.
But the problem is that the way we're doing things now and the way we think things are is a result of 70 years of unlimited access to low-cost carbon energy. Okay. That's why we have freeways. There is no way we would ever have freeways if we didn't have access to oil in the way that we have. And just everything that we do, long haul flights, you know, just keep going. And so the problem can't possibly be how do we continue the low cost, profligate use of energy frame, you know, how do we keep doing that, but with some other kind of energy that physically isn't possible. So there's a downshift of what we use fossil fuel for. This is the next trap that we get into, is that if you finally get to the point where you understand fossil fuels are the problem, that you automatically go, oh, but we can't do without fossil fuels. Right? That's just not possible.
So energy for data centers, a fool's errand is the question mark. It's time to take a big step back and figure out just how much is the real gain and how much a mirage from all our data processing and storage and AI. And in a world where we're already challenged with a bleak energy future, I can't help wondering at the intelligence of pursuing artificial intelligence. If you get a load of this, according to a graph from or chart from Visual Capitalist, already almost 9% of all electricity in the US is used to power data centers. Expect that to rise to 12%, it says, and that's just in 3 years, and on the back of AI, which is already propelling it. Virginia in the States is already at a staggering 26%. Over a quarter of all of its energy is just powering data centers. New Zealand and Australia aren't doing well, depends on how you measure doing well. We are the fourth country. There's 8.9 in the US, 5.1 in the UK, 4.8 in the EU, and Australia and New Zealand sit at 3.7%. That's not a metric we ought to be particularly proud of. Okay, we lack the minerals to even make the system work. When minerals gurus like Finland's Simon Michaud explain we can't even produce the minerals for one global round of renewable electrification, then we have to get our energy priorities very clear. And for me, it's not AI or data centers. I'll give a link to Simon Michaud's staggering reports on all of this. And that limitation, it plays into the oil company's hands, because the more we get hooked on AI, the more energy we use, and the more that will make it harder to get off fossil fuel generation, and the more fossil fuels we will need to construct the renewable infrastructure. Not the best news. Okay, Hannah Ritchie has a foot in both the energy and the AI camps. This is a follow-up from the last energy item. Hannah Ritchie, you may remember, she is Our World in Data. She's one of the brains behind that. And she also runs a blog called Sustainability by Numbers. And she reports that ChatGPT actually has a smaller carbon footprint than originally thought. Okay, that's good. But she concludes, quoting, "The fact that AI chatbots are a small part of most individuals' footprints does not mean that AI and data centers as a whole are not a problem for energy use and carbon emissions. I think that," and this is still Hannah Ritchie, "I think that particularly at a local level, managing load growth will be a challenge." And she doesn't even factor in the challenge of keeping on making the generating hardware that Simon Michaud has identified as a problem. We've got I've given another stark energy perspective, also from Visual Capitalist, but I'm not going to talk about that because I was called out by a climate consultant saying that data was inaccurate. So we will leave that without going any further into it. So we're not going to leave energy right now, because about the same time we had on my desk, I got a quote from Trump on energy and Shane Jones on energy. And my banner headline says, "Spot the Difference. Two politicians, the same songbook." Here's a quote from energy cost from Donald Trump. "Cut energy and electricity costs by half in 12 months," he said. Jones, "Make New Zealand the most competitively priced energy in the OECD. Both governments undermined the renewable transition. And what did prices do? In the US, I'm quoting, they skyrocketed," close quotes. That's from Bill McKibben. "And in New Zealand," I'm quoting, "rising faster than inflation." That's from Radio New Zealand. We'll give a link to both of those. And I'm quoting again from Bill McKibben, "We live on a planet where the cheapest way to make power is to point a sheet of glass at the sun." And now here's what Trump had to say about energy supply. "Energy supply, all far too inadequate." That sounds like Trump, doesn't it? "All far too inadequate to drive our nation's manufacturing, transportation, agriculture, and defense industries." That was his first day in office. Here's what Shane Jones said. "Manufacturing is threatened. Jobs are on the line due to shortage of energy. At least Jones is calling out our appalling Jen Taylor cabal." He did say that the way they collaborated on pricing was not at all good. Here's what Donald Trump had to say about coal. Quotes, "reinvigorating America's beautiful, clean coal industry." I'll give a link to the White House paper where that is recorded. Here's what Shane Jones says. "We are the only Western nation that I know of that is transitioning to coal." And that is quoted in the Hansard. We'll also give you a link. And that seems to be a good spot to go to our second clip from Susan Cromdyke. And she is responding to, in the interview from me, to me saying, if you had a magic climate strategy wand, how would you help us decarbonize at 10% per year every year? Here's what Susan had to say to that.
Yes, I know we're up to 10% per year. And I remember the first, I think when my book was published, when I finished writing in 2019, it was 6% per year.
Yeah,
and when
exactly.
I first started talking about this in my class in, you know, at Canterbury University, it was 1.5% per year. Mm-hmm. So we have been going totally the wrong direction. And that's just math. That's not politics whatsoever. That's just math. So my magic wand would be New Zealand. Next year, we have it on good authority that we're only going to get 90% of the oil that we used in 2018. So that's a known amount of oil. Mm-hmm. It's less than we're used to using. Go Apollo 13 that, right? Just go figure it out. And you start scratching your head. Oh, and by the way, the year after that, it's going to be 20% less.
Yeah.
And the year after that, it's going to be 30% less. And what you find out pretty quickly is that your problem-solving brains will be able to frame up that problem, do the math, do some engineering, do some problem solving, and figure out that doing one project that downshifts your fossil fuel use to the 80% less target lets you do the design, the redesign, the reset, the better way anyway.
Well, Susan does have a knack for putting it very clearly and directly, doesn't she? Right, a hotter tip for a cooler planet. Do vote for climate ambitious candidates. Encourage others to vote, especially encourage young people to vote. Then Climate Matters number 138 went through a whole string of links to all of the candidates that I interviewed, not candidates, specialists that I interviewed 3 years ago. I'll quickly recap the names. Susan Cromdyke, who we've got clips from today. Then there was James Shaw, the then climate change minister, Mirjana Stevens from Wakatu Incorporation, Olivia Hyatt, Penny Molnar and Joanna Santa Barbara, both well known in the Nelson Tasman regions, Simon Stewart, a freshwater ecologist at Cawthron, and another Simon Miller, who's a lead of the Pure Advantage organization. the late Rod Oram. We've already played some clips from Rod, and Ali Boswick, who's the lead of the Nelson Chamber of Commerce, Professor Rafe Chapman at Victoria University, a specialist in urban planning, and Sam Archer from the New Zealand Green Building Council, Emeritus Professor Pat Bodger, who was a Professor of Power Engineering at Canterbury, Professor James Renwick, Climate Professor at Victoria, Sophie Hanford, well-known Kapiti District Councillor, and finally a close-up from Professor Bronwyn Hayward, who summed it all up. What a list. So we'll give you a link where you can find all of those. Now, when is an answer not an answer? And this is me filling in a gap. A big apologies to readers who, in Climate Matters 137, tried to find the answer to the quiz question, what is hydrogel bioink? And a listener or reader in that case, Roger, pointed out that I hadn't actually given the answer, just repeated a bit of an article that didn't explain it. Well, here's what a hydrogel bioink is. It's a specialized product for 3D printing matrix structures that are capable of holding large quantities of water, and so they simulate the environment of living cells. They're largely developed for tissue engineering and medicine, but the article in Climate Matters 137 referenced its use as the basis for green coatings for products like building materials. That's not green in the color sense, that's green in the organic sense. And they could progressively sequester carbon from the air as an organism. And we'll give another link to that if you want to go back into it. Okay, how are we going for time? I think I've got time to do a little bit of a look at a reader challenge in response to 137, Climate Matters 137, in which I had a piece on, if you may recall, global warmers and global coolers. And I wrote, agriculture emits few cooling species, gases, which when we think it through is yet another reason to slash methane production ASAP, because that's a way of rapidly reducing warming without also reducing cooling effects. Well, Peter of Nelson sent in a response. He said, I squirm to criticize anything in your fantastic long-running Climate Matters, so thank you, Peter, for that. But I really think we shouldn't just talk about methane from agriculture. It feeds the narrative that it's all of agriculture that's producing this methane. I think we need to continually reference that agricultural methane in New Zealand is almost all from ruminants, and almost all ruminant methane worth talking about is from dairy cows and beef cattle. And then Peter just went on to say, there is hardly any methane from our poultry, our pigs, and none from our kiwi fruit, our avocados, our wine industry, etc. So well said, Peter. Thanks for that. I'm not going to get defensive about what I wrote. I was trying to be tight on space. But anyway, I did go into the question. If we look at a chart from the New Zealand greenhouse gas inventory, and it highlighted that methane from ruminants accounts for 43.1% of our national emissions, and dairy emits just over half of that, and sheep and beef about a quarter each. So that's a relatively small sector emitting a lot of methane. Crunching the numbers, methane from just cattle and sheep account for 80% of all greenhouse gas emissions from New Zealand ag, not counting another 5.4% from nitrous oxide associated with the same animals. So it is a big deal. It's a big deal to pick up on Peter's comment about low emissions from other sectors. The stats show, and there's a diagram in the hard copy of Climate Matters, we can see that all the rest of New Zealand agriculture accounts for only 4.6% of national emissions, or around a tenth of the heating impact of ruminant methane. So the question is there, why is there such resistance to reducing ruminant farming generally, and dairy farming especially? I've often saluted farmers and the challenges they face, and made the point that other sectors, like construction, have yet to feel the the heat on decarbonisation, like farming. But I'm also deeply critical of farming organisations and Fed farmers especially for obstructing change that's so much in the long-term interests of their own members as well as the rest of the world. So we might keep in mind that much of our huge dairy sector is quite recent, which to some degree is a counter-argument to people that claim that dairy farming is in every farmer's blood. It was obviously some long-standing dairy farms, but not all the time. And anyway, finally, let's never forget that despite this government's smoke and mirrors with what it called its methane review panel, slashing agricultural methane emissions remains one of the single greatest contributions New Zealand can make in the global quest to preserve a livable future for our children and for their children. That brings us to the end of this episode of Climate Matters. Thanks so much for your company. As you know, Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson-Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz. And on that note, thank you again for your company. I hope I enjoy it next week. And of course, kia kaha for the climate.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.